to me. Talk to me. Welcome to Dialogue, KSFR's Friday evening talk show, where the conversation starts with you. I'm your host, MK. As of late, I've decided to take this program to the streets, to talk to you, the listener. But the voices I've been particularly interested in hearing from are those that often go overlooked, unseen, not just invisible, but above all, misunderstood. Over the past few weeks, I've decided to do a series on what is one of the great open dialogue. Throughout the country are experiencing similar success. Best advocates. Peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. Best advocates. Peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. Best advocates. Peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. Best advocates. Peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. Best advocates. Peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. Best advocates. Peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And their advocates. Peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been advocates. Peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been advocates. Peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been advocates. Peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been advocates. Peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been other peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others. Peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others. Peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others. Peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout. Peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout. Peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout. Peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout. Peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout. Peer respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout history. Respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout history. Respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout history. Respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout history. Respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout history. Respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout history. Respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout history. Respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout history. Respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout history. Respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout history. Respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout history. Respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout history. Respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout history. Respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout history. Respite houses throughout the country are experiencing similar success. And there have been others throughout history, like Soteria House. There's also the Hearing Voices Network, with a group right here in Santa Fe, out of the counseling center, LifeLink. With a nation undergoing what feels like a literal cultural war, it's easy to get discouraged in today's world of seemingly growing division. But there's also an increasing number of brave people coming forward to speak up and out, where long-held shame is finally being lifted, unveiling an equally more tolerant world where unity is claimed across all issues facing humanity's future. And while I can be devastated by the division, this light is what catches my eye. I'm encouraged by the young voices I see, with bold, courageous expectation to be treated better by a world we told them ought to treat them better. Now they hold us to the standard we laid out for them, and we call them entitled. They resist and pave their own way, courageously and creatively, carving out the future that will belong to them. Their actions call into question our own frustrations, manners in which we ourselves have chosen to settle a step beyond what we thought would be comfortable. While working on this series, I first spoke with a young 24-year-old, brilliant artist, the Rah Rah Rabbit, who hears voices and speaks about it on YouTube, where he has developed his own personal therapy of using lucid dreaming to help manage his voices, and where his videos have gone viral and he's developed a social media following. Last week, I spoke with a brave, loving mother who shared the story of her son, Nico, who is almost in a permanent state of psychosis after 13 years of treatment by our standard psychiatric system. She revealed the journey through the current system she's now chosen to abandon, despite exceedingly limited resources, because the fear is it will only continue to do more damage than good, as it already has proven to do. This week, I wanted to talk to some of the innovators of these new therapies. We sat down to talk about the variety of new solutions, and yet, at root, was an unspoken exhaustion that comes with continually swimming upstream, wrestling to twist oneself into the proper form so as not to offend, yet pave new paths forward with only dwindling resources. And so, we chose to do something else. Simply seize the moment. Dare to be ourselves. Dare to remove the usual masks we wear as therapists, as journalists, presenting new information and answers, and rather simply speak our truths. An attempt, alone and together, to ask ourselves how we move forward.
The reality is, this is Louisa Putnam speaking.
Kermit Cole.
And M.K. Mendoza.
And we are all people whose families have been through the hell of the mental health system.
Yeah.
And having family members who were diagnosed and drugged and who died.
Yep.
And we're also talking about our experience with trying to do something to change that, to have other families have different outcomes.
Yeah, looking for better treatments, some kind of alternative, better treatments than the current system that exists.
Yeah, and better understandings of, as you were saying, as you say, Kermit, and I'd love you to pipe in about this, that this is not an individual pathology. This is a relational phenomenon.
Mental illness, what we call mental illness, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so we look at our families, and different people in our families became the ones that carried that cross, that stigma, But we've also, all of us, have looked at, looked with as big a view as we can get, being humans, about it, and found that it wasn't that simple. It wasn't that somebody had an incurable brain disease.
As we were told.
As we were told, it was progressive. It required these psychiatric drugs that ruined their brains and their psyches.
How do you know that it wasn't?
How do I know that it wasn't? How do I know it wasn't incurable? In my son's case, it was an incurable brain disease.
It was, in the sense that
he ended up taking his life. So it was incurable in the sense that in his lifetime, it didn't get cured. But it didn't get cured because the kind of help that was available to our family and the kind of beliefs that members of our family had been taught by the culture was that it was an incurable brain disease. My experience was that it was something that we needed as a family, as a community, to give attention to, with everybody bringing their weakness and vulnerability and mistakes and everything and putting it all there together to hold together so that that one person didn't have to carry it.
Yep, absolutely.
For everyone else.
I mean, I definitely have to say that I shared that feeling in my family, the desire for all of us to kind of own this, and that my dad was the outsider or the one with the problem, the scapegoat. And then even if you sided with him in any way, then you were possibly labeled crazy too, and then that works against you. I mean, I think the whole system is way more damaging than it is helpful. I literally believe that it created the illness in my dad much more than he ever had it. I think he had an episode. And if he had had a different course of treatment, a system that dealt with him in a more humane way and actually listened to what he had to say, that it would have been a whole different story. We would have grown to learn from him. He was a visionary, he was ahead of his time. He was having kind of a spiritual crisis. And he did some bold things that looked pretty crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But if you listen to why he did what he did, it wasn't so crazy. It made a lot of sense,
mm-hmm.
actually.
Mm-hmm.
But for whatever reason, we as a society couldn't
mm-hmm.
validate that in him. And he was leaving us. He was abandoning our family, in a sense, for this new crisis he was going through. And
mm-hmm.
we were getting left in that process. And it was terrifying because he was our rock.
Mm-hmm.
He was at the helm of the adventure in life, leading the way.
Mm-hmm.
And to lose him was
mm-hmm.
kind of devastating. And our family to be falling apart like that, because we were a fairly tight-knit family. We were very focused on the family,
mm-hmm.
the need for family.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're Sicilian.
What's up?
Sicilian.
No, Colombian and Swiss.
Oh,
yeah. But that abandonment, I think, just scared the hell out of our family. And then, of course, here comes the psychiatric system saying they've got the solution to why our dad is leaving us, basically, in
mm-hmm.
a sense, abandoning us. And it was an easy course of, easy solution. It seemed like, oh, okay, yeah, just take your pill and follow the rules and we'll follow them with you, even though in our gut something about it just didn't feel right.
Mm-hmm.
Never did for me anyway. He protested. He didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end he went along because
mm-hmm.
it was, you know, for his family. Literally, he said, I will take this drug for my family.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to take these drugs. I don't like it. I don't agree with it. And but I'll do it for the love of my family.
Mm-hmm.
And then only to see his condition worsen over
mm.
his lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where, I mean, as I said in Dr. Bragan's show, he started out as a oral surgeon that was asked on to do his residency. First oral surgeon ever asked on at Yale to do his residency there because he was that good.
Mm.
By the end of his life, he was as close to a chemical lobotomy as I can describe or that I've ever seen. My family members might disagree with me, but I saw him in the last, I spent hours and hours, days with him in the last days of his life, and couldn't speak anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't, I mean, it was tragic. And of course I'm railing against a system that I'm saying he's over-medicated, and they just won't hear it. And of
mm-hmm.
course I'm stigmatized too, because you're the daughter of that crazy guy, so therefore you're suspect.
Mm-hmm. And I was the mother of the crazy guy.
So you're suspect.
And you're the brother of the...
Yeah, so I was going to say, so what, I'm curious about your situation, Kermit. Like, what was your experience?
Well, bottom line is I had two sisters who, about the time, one 7 years older, one a year and a half younger. The younger one, as it happens, was adopted. And why that matters is because the two sisters kind of, in the course of things, you know, had the same diagnoses, pretty much same trajectory. And so if we're looking for an experiment, you know, nature nurture experiment, we got a pretty good one right there.
Yeah.
And I was told the whole time I was growing up that the diagnosis was borderline, paranoid, schizophrenic, character disorder, personality disorder, born without a conscience, inability to love.
Wow.
Was the diagnosis for both of them. And then, you know, when it would land on the inability to love part, I would hear that and look inside myself for the ability to love and couldn't find it. So I knew that if I let that secret out, then all the other diagnoses would come tumbling down on me. So I hid that part. But that meant I came into adulthood pretty much, you know, the one thing that I knew for sure about me was that I didn't know how to love. And a lot of years later, when I talked to one of my brothers about that, he said, know, this is a hard thing to say, but there's no way to avoid it, but to say, he said, no, you don't, it's not that you couldn't love, it's just you couldn't love our mother.
Yeah.
And, which was pretty on the target.
Mm-hmm.
But actually what's more true is that she's somebody who is almost impossible to successfully love.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the terms of, like, compensate for all of the traumas that she had experienced.
Yeah, for generations.
Yeah, all the generations of trauma, the pogroms and the you know, leaving Eastern Europe to escape death and coming to a country that in which they were hated and, you know, all the... And then, in you know, within that, you know, and then arrive, you know, getting here just to, you know, create a life, and then go broke in the depression and all the emotional abuse that she got from her mother, which was severe, you know, just as serious as anything I've ever heard or seen.
Whose father committed suicide?
His father committed, yeah, her father, her grandfather committed suicide when he lost everything in the depression. And and also her father, you know, serially molesting her, as far as he was able to, given that he was impotent, and her mother feeling jealous of the fact that the father was even attempting to have sex with her daughter,
yeah,
just left her jealous of the daughter.
Not laughing because it's funny.
Yeah, hating her. And then all of that just fell right on my sister's heads.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up watching them being, well, I didn't understand it to be abuse. This was home. But if any of them, you know, if the laws were on the books then that are on the books now, then when, you know, when my younger sister went to school with welts on her, questions would have been asked.
Yeah.
She would have been, you know, taken away, probably. And that's ultimately what happened, was she ended up being made a ward of the state when she was about 14, and I was 15. And I was told, you know, my mom tried to get me to promise never to talk to my sister again because she was, you know, paranoid, schizophrenic, character disorder, personality disorder, borderline, you know, et cetera. Anyway, so over the years I tried to talk to her. I didn't know how to. I didn't know what, you know, and it was also very difficult for me, as we were saying, to go against, even though I, at the time, I didn't agree to not talk with her. And because of that, my mom didn't talk to me for 2 months at all. So, you know, pretty clear signal.
Yeah.
And, but I also didn't talk to her, except for every, you know, few years I'd take a stab at it. But I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
And so eventually, when my life wasn't really adding up the way I hoped, you know, because I went into the film business and, you know, had the kind of success that I hoped to have and realized it wasn't actually solving any of the problems that I thought it would solve. And then I realized, oh, I got to go figure out what this whole borderline personality disorder, character disorder, schizophrenic, paranoid schizophrenic, born without a conscience thing is.
Yeah.
And I ended up going back to school, and just by happenstance ended up going to a good one. You know, like, if you want to go to a school where supposedly they have the answer to these questions, this would be one of those schools. Ivy League. And so I spent, you know, a good few years in the library trying to understand what all these terms meant and realized that they were all, you know, barely better than a spell out of Harry Potter. And I also participated in serious research, and within that realized it was all kind of a, you know, pretty And when you talk to people on the inside, they say they would say the same. And privately, they wouldn't say that publicly.
Right, which I think that's the root issue right there. There's a public conversation going on about all these treatments and the system and the psychiatric care, and then there's a private conversation. Mm-hmm. And the private, the real story, isn't the one that's getting told.
No.
And that's what we're having right here. We're talking about how and why it didn't work.
Yeah. I talked to Harvard professors, which is where I was,
yeah,
who publicly are the ones that, the go-to ones for interviews on all these topics. And they would say, this is what happens to happen, that's what has to happen. And then I'd go to them privately and say, is that what you would do with your kid?
Yeah.
And right. They'd say, well, I know how to raise my kid.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, and interesting, too, that you mentioned the multiple diagnoses. I mean, that seems to just is kind of part and parcel of any of these diagnoses to me. They seem to compound. It's never just sort of a singular, or it doesn't seem to be. It wasn't in my case with my dad. And I know there's other cases like mine. It wasn't... it starts out with bipolar, and then it's, schizoaffective, narcissism, we don't really know what he has. It's some mix of all of these things. And meanwhile, I'm sort of going, what do you think we have? I wonder what we suffer from. Because I think some of what he's talking about is pointing the finger at our own flaws that would be worth and worthy of examining.
As well.
Yeah.
For sure. Instead.
And you are listening to Dialogue, KSFR's Friday evening talk show, where the conversation starts with you. We'll be right back after these short messages. And we are back, and you're listening to Dialogue, where today we're talking about how to move forward in finding better solutions to the current paradigm of mental health care.
We're all the blind men holding parts of the elephant. We all have different experiences in this system, of family members in the psychiatric system. And out of that, I was already a therapist when Lucas became unwell, and I didn't know how to help him. But I knew that the way of drugging and diagnosing wasn't going to help him. But I had other family members who bought the broken brain narrative. So our family became polarized around that. There are still family members that are, aligned with that perspective, giving drugs to their, or wanting their family members to be treated in that way. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, yeah. And I just don't know how much of that is founded in shame and guilt, as Dr. Peter Gregan talks about, survivor guilt and complicity in the process. I think I could speak somewhat openly about my mother because we've come to the other side and come to a greater understanding of each other's positions. Mm-hmm. And when she heard Robert Whittaker, she herself kind of took a big gulp and went, oh my God, this explains so much. Because I think there's a part of that gut in all of us, because we know that, this is what I was saying on with Dr. Reagan, is we know that we are relational beings. We know that we affect each other. And when someone just gets diagnosed as the problem, it's a scapegoat. And there's a part of us, all of us, that knows that that's going on. And I remember looking at research that says that the person who, the people who ostracize actually suffer more than the person who is ostracized. And I thought that's interesting. So I think there's part of a resistance to want to hear the truth, and yet once they hear it, there's also a relief in it of like, oh my God, that explains so much. And if I can just be forgiven now for having taken the wrong road, because we just didn't know. We didn't know better. Yeah. There was no Robert Whittaker. There was Peter Reagan. Mm-hmm. There were other people holding that. There are lots of people that are now coming out of the woodwork in MIA. You guys included in that. Mm-hmm. But we didn't know about each other. I think that's the biggest part of this.
No, it's very isolating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was fortunate to run across Dan Macker's video called "Take These Broken Wings." I recommend it to people.
Yeah.
And then I reached out to him, and through Dan, I was introduced to this group of people, which eventually led me to meeting Kermit, who are all giving attention to this phenomenon going on the planet, and the fact that this is spreading to other cultures. I wish I could remember the name of the movie about the pharmaceutical industry introducing depression as a concept to Japan.
Mm, yeah.
Very intense film.
And now we're sort of blindly following along as if
know
all.
We are not.
We're not. We are not. So
yeah.
Those of us who did
listened.
And I think that's where I've reached a point of I can't hear that side as much anymore. Because I did listen, I took its advice, I followed the game, and it didn't work out. And now I think it's your turn to hear our side of the story. I just do. I think as professionals, if you have your ethic as do no harm, I think it's your actual obligation to listen to these stories.
Mm-hmm.
And we, the people who have suffered them, need to have the courage to speak them as well. Reaching this point of being like, I'm done. I mean, I think that we're all sort of talking about that. And done with the system. I think in a way it had to get to this point in order to move it forward to where it really needs to go. But I could be wrong, I don't know. What do you think about that? Or do you think it's just hopeless? Just throw up our hands and say, forget it. Swimming upstream.
It's not that simple. You know, I mean, I just think this is the current form of a perennial struggle. Something that we like to feel membership in a group, and right now we're saying, you know, what we're saying is, oh, we want to feel membership in the group of people who have come to realize all the harm that psychiatry has done, and that there's a better way. Well, that's great. It's great to be a part of the trek. We have to be very careful not to say, oh, and we have to kill the other tribe.
Mm-hmm.
that's where things get to, you know, that's mm-hmm. where things get difficult.
Yeah.
Because when I say I'm done, I'm like, you know, I mean, right now we're starting, you know, work at a family therapy group, which exists because it gets referrals from the system.
Mm-hmm.
When somebody gets referred, and then we had this conversation, somebody got, I think if I remember correctly, we got a referral, and it was somebody who'd been diagnosed schizophrenic. And I think I remember you basically saying, well, you should say to them, we don't believe in schizophrenia as a concept. And my response was, I'd rather get the person. Because if somebody referring to me says, I want to refer to you as schizophrenic, or what I did say was, I responded, I left a message on the social worker's phone. I said, I understand you have somebody with a schizophrenia diagnosis. I'd like to talk to you. Never got a call back. Now, I don't imagine that the person heard the air quotes that I put around.
Right.
You know, but they might have.
Yeah, but language is important. It's very important.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, to me, do I want to stand my ground on this
mm-hmm.
and say, no, you unknown social worker that I've never met before, you are wrong to use this term schizophrenia.
Yeah, I totally.
Or do I want to get that person under my care?
Yeah.
And then in a month or 2 months or 3 months, say, hey, you and the family, maybe there's another way to look at this.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe say to the psychiatrist, you know, I understand, okay, not arguing the point on the schizophrenia, but I'm beginning to pick up some dissociative things. I'm beginning to pick up some, you know, family history, you know, some traumatic, you know, like alcoholism, blah, blah,
mm-hmm.
blah. That could explain some of this.
Mm-hmm.
Could explain it.
Mm-hmm.
Not arguing the diagnosis, because that's not my place. And if I start arguing it, then I know I'm going to be off the team. Today.
This is critical. What you're talking about. because I think it's about strategizing a way forward.
And if I remember right, I think I might have been a little bit more to the left. If I remember, you know, where I, if they were listening for it, they would hear some that I am somebody who doesn't buy the diagnosis. Just, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's brand new, even the idea that we can come out and say, I mean, it's brand new for me anyway, that I can loudly, out loud say so-called mental illness. Because even by saying that, I'm already identifying with the crazies and being put in that camp. And I just don't, but this is the way I've now come to see it, is especially because we have places like Mad in America, madamerica.com, and Dr. Peter Breggin, Open Dialogue, the kind of work you guys are doing, people that are out there with alternative thinking about this. For years I thought I was just alone, thinking that maybe my dad and I were the only ones who saw it slightly differently. For years I just didn't think there was anyone else who saw it in any way like I did, and so I was terrified to kind of come out about it. But now that I've found this community of people, my tribe, I feel as though you guys are my tribe, and now I can say, and I just am calling it out, I'm going to say so-called mental illness because I believe it is a point of view. I believe it is a belief system. And if I was from another culture that didn't believe in mental illness, I would have the right to say I don't believe in that. Just because I believe in this, because I'm a part of this culture, doesn't mean I have to believe everything this culture believes. I don't like football. I have the right not to like football. I don't want to go to church. I have the right not to want to go to church. If I don't want to go into the primary healthcare system for my healthcare, I can go to an acupuncturist, or I can seek alternative treatments. So when it comes to mental health, I should be able to do the same thing. I have that right to claim that I just disagree. Just a point of disagreement.
Challenge the paradigm.
Yeah, without challenging it in a way that offends it, but simply to say, interesting, thank you for that information. And I don't happen to believe, I don't agree with your point of view, but that's okay. It works for you, and that's good. It didn't work for me, so I'm kind of going elsewhere.
What I've found is that as long as the interest is in keeping the dialogue going and creating more of it and being more curious and being more exploratory, then we tend to arrive in the places that I would prefer. And what's dangerous is when those ways of thinking that are focused on coming up with an answer that is definitive and saying, okay, we got it, that's it. Then, you know, it's a really good feeling to think that you have the definitive answer. It wasn't by saying, you know, bang, when I've had good outcomes clinically, it wasn't by proving my point,
right,
and proving others wrong.
Yeah,
it was by saying, all right, let's, I'm seeing there's maybe another way to look at this. So let's keep it open.
Let's
just not close in on a schizophrenia diagnosis, or let's reopen it.
Right.
Let's just keep talking.
Yeah.
And I think there's, you know, so that's one thing is, you know, and it's one way I think about the whole open dialogue thing, is it's just about saying, let's keep the dialogue open.
Yeah, anything is possible. I mean, I like that idea too. In that, And also, I have to add, I mean, even like when it comes to schizophrenia, when there's a lot of theory behind the trauma, and for me, I'm opening up this idea of it being maybe related more to sleep. Sleep disorder of some kind.
Exploring that.
I am exploring. Yeah. And you know, one thing that I have discovered in this process is I have learned, and I remember my dad saying this, I know that I don't know anymore. I just know that it's possible not to know certainly anything anymore, because there were times I was 100% on board with the biochemical imbalance, the state. I bought it hook, line, and sinker. I, you know, And then it didn't work. And then Robert Whittaker comes along, I get new explanations, it helped put more pieces together, but I will be the first to say tomorrow, suddenly they could find a chemical imbalance, and I'd go, oh, okay, wait a minute, now this changes the picture again. I mean, you know.
Well, as a matter of fact, I mean, this is a really important point I wanted to get to also, is that as far as keeping the dialogue open and why I'm really very much, we have to be very careful about making others wrong.
Yes.
Because, for instance, the theory that you're putting forth, that schizophrenia has something to do with sleep deprivation.
Yeah.
That is a biomedical
yes.
model of schizophrenia.
Yeah, it is.
That is a chemical imbalance
yeah,
model of
is.
Schizophrenia.
It is. And I find myself going back there.
Well, it is.
So and what if I could be? What if
so,
there's something to it?
But I'm not saying that to say it's wrong.
No.
I'm saying it's a perfectly valid way to look at some situations in which people's behavior is puzzling and frightening.
Yeah.
It's because they haven't had enough sleep. Because actually, right. the brain at that time, without sleep, in fact, is chemically imbalanced in a
yeah.
very fundamentally true way.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
when you need sleep in order to clean out the waste products of metabolism in the brain. And
yeah.
when you don't get enough sleep,
yeah.
you have a buildup of toxic waste products.
Yeah.
Yeah. That impair your cognitive abilities. That's biomedical. That's chemical imbalance.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's true. So when
yeah.
when people push back and say, oh, you're a lunatic for thinking that, you know, that schizophrenia is all about psychosocial.
Yeah.
Well, of course, you know, and of course we keep saying, well, I'm not saying only that. I'm saying
right.
and that.
And
the
I
problem
think that's
is
really...
when we the problem is anytime somebody tries to say, what is schizophrenia? We need the answer. We need the one thing.
Yes.
The problem is, well, there isn't one thing. Schizophrenia in my book is somebody's behaving strangely and we don't know why.
Exactly. And yeah.
And that's just mm-hmm. I can say that with some authority because
right.
I have worked in schizophrenia research at Harvard.
Right.
With some of the top researchers there.
Right.
So, and I know behind the scenes they say, we don't know anything.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But I know, but back then, you know, back in 2000 when I started doing that work, you know, I came in and I said, you know, guys, I don't think I buy this schizophrenia concept. And they would just kind of laugh at me and just say, yeah, do your work. And then, you know, some years later they were like, yeah, looks like maybe there's nothing here.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much the state of play now.
Yes.
In the top echelons of research, as they're saying. It's like, yeah. I mean, actually, the top schizophrenia researcher in the UK, now that he's retired, says, yeah, schizophrenia is a flawed concept. It's caused more harm than good, and we need to get rid of it.
Yeah. Sir Robin Murray.
Yeah, Robin Murray.
And back to, this is what I think we have to be cognizant of and diligent about is remembering when we're attaching money to the game.
Yeah.
Because when we attach money to the game, there's a vested interest and
yeah.
We want to believe it. We.
But it's all yeah, and that's
don't say
and,
we.
Puts money in our pocket.
And that's talking about you know and yes, the medical profession is culpable for that, and I think psychiatry is culpable for that. On the other hand. I'm not on board with saying that there is no place for something that is called the field of psychiatry. I mean, I think some, you know, having an understanding of how physical conditions impact our mental, cognitive, emotional states
mm-hmm.
is a valid thing.
Yeah.
Because anything from a thorn in the foot that we don't know about to...
Yeah.
Or
a food allergy.
Allergies, low blood sugar.
Diabetes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, I mean, when I have a cold, I'm delirious.
Mold.
Yeah.
When I have the flu,
mm-hmm.
I'm psychotic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, but we know why.
Right.
We know why.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the difference.
Yeah.
But anytime that we don't know why,
yeah.
we call it schizophrenia.
Yeah.
But every few years, something that's been called schizophrenia gets isolated out as something else. Or once... Somebody who's been called schizophrenic, we find, oh, they have a tumor, or oh, they have a
mm-hmm.
this or that,
yeah.
and sometimes, or some neurological condition that is affecting their brain. Well, great, you know. Now we say, oh, now we know that they have a medical condition, not a neuropsychiatric condition.
Mm-hmm. yeah,
I go back to saying, but to say that they have schizophrenia means, you know, that's basically code for we have no idea.
Yeah, you know, my dad used to argue things like that. He used to make that exact point.
Yeah. Well, that's the state of
your own words.
Yeah. Well, just that we have to create labels and names for things because it helps us feel safe and mm-hmm. categorize things. It makes us feel in control, like we have the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I even remember when we were kind of in the midst of this, of his crisis, his initial episode, him saying things to me like, the only constant in life is change.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, I remember how much that just upset me because it's like my whole family is falling apart and I don't want to hear that there's going to be change. I want you sticking around and being the same old person you always have been and what's going on. You know, I just remember having a physical, biological response to that notion. But in fact, he's right. The only constant in life is change. And I think this is, in large part, has a lot to do with our inability to be in uncomfortable places where we just don't know.
Yeah.
And we have to be the expert. We have to know. We have to have it, as you said, back to that. We have to find an answer. We have to have a definitive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's about control to a large degree.
Mm-hmm. Or we will, or people want to go to someone who is the authority.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do want to say, though, that there have been times in our work with people where we were thankful that there was a place where people could get safe.
Yeah.
And be kept safe.
Be kept safe, yeah.
Yeah. And in some of the models that we admire that in the world, when it's needed, people are put on medication, low doses, and for as short a period of time as it's needed to, Kermit, you've said, for the family to rest.
Yeah, yeah. And the patient themselves.
And the patient to rest.
You know,
yeah.
And it, yeah, again, back to that containment. It's like, oh, we don't want to contain, but there are moments
where you
somebody,
have to.
Yeah. But the key is, if we could just do it in a more supportive manner, as opposed to this sort of, we just need to include the person, back to that concept of, can we allow this person to have a voice in their own so-called diagnosis?
Yeah. And be informed about the effects of the drugs too, which I remember when my son Luke was in that, it was, people would say, don't. I mean, if you tell him, he's not going to want to take them.
Yeah. Well, and the informed consent, I mean, that's without question something that has to be advocated for. We've got to know that if they had said, well, and by the way, and when he comes off these drugs suddenly, you might see him get more manic than he's ever been. It's not the disease returning.
No.
That could potentially be what you're seeing as a withdrawal effect, not just potentially, but I believe scientifically
is
proven to be so.
Yeah.
I'm remembering being with a mother and a psychiatrist when the mother said, I've been reading and I understand that these drugs can potentially kill my son. And the psychiatrist said, well, yeah, but it's better than being psychotic.
Right. No, that's yeah.
And she just was, as you'd expect, she was in tears.
Yeah.
But that's. I guess it's a little. It is dicey because I've been in situations where I went and got Haldol for somebody to keep something worse from happening, mm-hmm. but then I stuck around and I watched them. And so, and then when I started seeing signs of toxicity, I called up the psychiatrist and said, but I was very careful not to say, I'm seeing signs of toxicity, I think I'm seeing, early neuroleptic malignant syndrome. Because
mm-hmm.
that would have, I think this particular psychiatrist would have, just said, who are you, you numbskull?
Mm-hmm.
I'm the prescriber here. I just said, this is what I'm seeing. This is the behavior I'm seeing. And he said, oh my God, take her off the Haldol right away.
Yeah.
So we did. But what I'm getting at here is, it's not easy because sometimes there ain't no choice.
Mm-hmm.
Like this particular person was, she was ending up in jail. She was ending up in hospitals. She was putting herself in very, very risky situations. I understood her problem to be you know, very clearly linked to, you know, a very traumatic childhood with alcoholic parents, you know, alcoholic, abusive, and neglectful parents. It was really clear to me. But that was, I didn't live in a world in which I could make that clarity into actionable form. I mean, I did, actually, and I did do, you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, this person is now off all those drugs.
Yeah.
Well, so, okay.
Can happen.
And happy, and doing
well. And doing well.
Uh-huh, so there can be turnaround.
But going back to the mother who, you know, was told, I mean, I guess the thing I was thinking at that time when she was told that potentially lethal drugs are better than psychosis, and in the short term, there's maybe an argument that for that, but in the longer term, actually, you know, I've been in a lot of situations where something that was being called psychosis, if you hold it, you know, lightly, hold it in the right way, find out what's really going on. I mean, basically, long story short, it becomes human. It becomes something that there's a very discernible emotional foundation on which this, you know, this cognitive formation has come to be.
Yeah, mm-hmm. To me it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think again back to that being comfortable with the uncomfortable. It's just when we see strange behavior, mm-hmm. it scares us. But if we can learn to be okay in that uncomfortable space and allow mm-hmm. it to just be what it is and
be curious about it, as you're saying.
Investigate a bit and mm-hmm. open, mm-hmm. unafraid, allow. Mm-hmm. Because I think in large part that's also part of what creates that psychosis, makes it worse, is everybody's fear and reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And,
for sure. Yeah.
And then it just deepens the alienation and isolation.
I think one of the main things, actually this is the main thing, mm-hmm. A lot of times in practice, and that's something that, is to just anything that can de-escalate the fear.
Yeah.
And so that's for sometimes, in some of the situations we've been in, it comes down to just saying to people, what exactly is it that you're afraid of?
Right.
You know, because I'm getting a very general kind of, very intense but nebulous fear.
Right.
And then you listen, and in one instance, I was like, oh, so your fear basically is that because of how your son is behaving right now, you're afraid that he's not going to someday have an IRA.
Right.
And the person's like, yeah, that's basically it. And I was like, okay, that's a different problem.
Right.
For which it's not justified to immediately medicate and hospitalize your son.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, he's saying things you don't understand. Let's just hang on here for a bit.
Right. And again, back to it becoming a family problem, not just an individual's mm-hmm. expression of it. You know, that they're the problem, but rather, and I think that again, in doing this series, it's been very a learning process for me of realizing how much more these diagnoses have to say about our fear than about the person who's actually suffering from those states of being.
One of the other ironies in that situation,
it's not just their fear, but everyone else's that's getting projected onto them, that then they have to deal with as well, right?
Yeah.
And I think this shame and guilt and fear and, you know, that is what stigma really basically is made up of, is all those things. And I know that for me, it was like, I call it putting on the stigma glasses, is, you know, the minute my dad's diagnosed. Conventional wisdom says it's, you know, it's biological, it's genetic, you know, you're going to get it too. So, you know, mm-hmm. everyone is looking at you through the eyes of mm-hmm. evidence for mm-hmm. a case of the crazies.
Mm-hmm.
And that would of course enrage me and terrify me as a child, because I didn't want to end up like my dad
mm-hmm.
And undergoing the same fate. And so I fought it like a mad woman. And of course they fight back with all that fear. And I think this happens in our families because we're exposed to the abuse of the psychiatric system that takes away your civil rights, that gives you no voice in your own so-called diagnosis, all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And it disempowers people to such a degree. And when we see the trauma of that experience, it is terrifying. I would rather have been beaten. There were times I just said, God, I wish my dad could have just been an alcoholic and beat me up like every other kid I know.
Mm-hmm.
But no, he was put into a system that I saw destroy him
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
his spirit above all. Mm-hmm. All in the name of doing it in his own good or for his own good, and us too, and destroy and fracture our family into a million pieces beyond recognition.
Mm-hmm.
So But anyway, back to this shame and blame game, and everybody's afraid of this terror. I mean, this terror lives within the household of the family.
Absolutely.
And yeah. And you're passing that terror around each other like a ball. Mm-hmm. And it's basically, to me, like this ball of shame. And nobody wants it landing on them. Now, there I am, maybe the next generation getting put away. Luckily, that never happened to me because I was smart enough to know how to avoid those pitfalls. And I just went to lots of therapy and sought my own answers and found them and maintained my sanity. And so I avoided that fate. Mm-hmm. But it was a daily struggle. And it took a lot out of my life, and a lot of my own human potential was lost in that battle. I mean, but again, back to the root of that is it's back in what you're talking about, Kermit, that we have the answers. We know all. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to accept anything less than you going with our program.
Take this pill.
Yeah, take it whether you like it or not. And if you don't like it, we're going to mandate it legally. Mm-hmm. So you have to, whether you want to or... I mean, it's the last civil rights battle of this century, as far as I'm concerned. But we're finding our way
together. We're finding our way. Yes. Yeah, and if this ends up on your radio program, just sending out best wishes to everyone that's listening, and maybe I'll be of help to one another.
Absolutely.
At the end of this three-part series, despite the tragedy reflected in some of these stories, I remain hopeful. In many ways, it feels as though the mental health care system is in the initial stages of where the alternative health movement might have been 50 years ago. Since we may be sitting at the precipice of a hashtag MeToo movement here, I believe the answer can be found, and in fact has been found, and proven, not just between each other, but ultimately within ourselves and what we know to be true. It lies in the evidence of our own eyes. The only thing left to do is trust it. Thank you for joining me. You've been listening to Dialogue, where the conversation starts with you. I'm your host, MK. See you next week, right here, Friday nights at 5.
Talk to me. Talk to me. Talk to me, talk to me.